Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are decades when nothing happens, said Vladimir Lenin, no less, and there are weeks when decades happen. It's felt a bit like the latter lately, uprisings and revolt, earthquake and tsunami, economic crash and change, more rock and roll to the world than we're used to. A good time to talk with Simon Schama. This hour On Point historian, journalist, critic, Simon Schama on living in the tumult of history now. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling a little overwhelmed lately by the news, by our moment in history? Are you ready for some perspective on the tumult of our time? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Simon Schama is a British-born scholar of revolution, art, history, and more, also a prolific journalist in print and broadcast whose work has ranged far and wide. He teaches history and art history at Columbia University in New York. His many books include The Power of Art, The American Future, and Rough Crossings. He's just out with a terrific collection of essays spanning four decades and a big swath of life and art. It's called Scribble, 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 Writing on Politics, Ice Cream, Churchill, and My Mother. He joins us from New York. Simon Schama, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Fantastic to be here. Thank you.
There's so much to dive into here, but first, you're an historian. Just the sense, I think a lot of people have it lately, maybe you have on certain days, I don't know, but you've studied so much. You tell us, are we living in particularly tumultuous times, or are we just sissies about it? Has it been, I mean, it can feel just overwhelming some days. I know a few weeks ago in particular, with all these revolts and uprisings in the Middle East and nuclear plants.
Hey, you know, Tom, take it easy. You can always go back to Charlie Sheen. You know, if you're overdosing on history.
But how about it? I mean, we don't want to feel sorry for ourselves or overwhelmed if it doesn't merit it.
No,
are we
just
in one of those moments?
Get used to it.
Get used to it.
We are living through one of those moments. Look, I'll tell you, there was one of the points where I thought I've got to become a historian was when I saw a really bad historical movie. I must have been about 11 or something. The movie was called Sword of Florence, and it purported to be about the life of Michelangelo. Mm. Why not? And at that moment, it was very, very low budget. A man called Edmund Purdom, you know, who was handsome, but and that was his major gift, as Michelangelo, jumped off his horse and waved his sword and said, "Men of Florence, the Renaissance is here." And he all said, "Yes, yes, Renaissance, it's us." So we are going through one of those sort of self-identifying, yeah, historically dramatic moments. And I suppose, you know, we need to eat as many Cheerios as will get us through it. But, I mean, when was there really a dull period? Maybe at some point in the 1990s before the dot-com bubble really exploded. And
Or Eisenhower's 50s, we're told.
Well, you know, Eisenhower's 50s was sort of duck and cover, actually.
Yes.
You know, it was a combination of tedium and imminent incineration. I remember, actually, when the Cuban Missile Crisis, again, men don't want to hear these stories of the small Sharma being awakened to history. But when the Cuban Missile Crisis came out, I was a bit older. I went home to my poor father, who did not deserve this, and said, "I'm about to be fried into a crisp, Dad, and it's all your fault."
Thanks a lot, Pops.
And he said, "It wasn't, son, really." I said, "Yes, you and your bloody generation." Well, now I'm the generation, really, so it's our fault, I guess. But turbulence we certainly have.
Men of Florence, the Renaissance is here, though. I mean, I think these days people would cheer if they could be told that by the sword-wielding horseman coming into town. Instead, it seems like
give us a bit of
horseman of the apocalypse
rather than Mama Gaddafi.
Well, we'll take the Renaissance over. I mean, you know, nukes up there and global warming, all the rest, I think it feels much more to many people like meltdown, not the Renaissance, but maybe it always feels like that, the beginning of something new.
No, I think there is a real difference, which is surprising. Here's, again, people of my generation grew up with really adamant certainties, the Cold War being one of them, I think, really. The sense in which also a sort of prosperity out of the suffering and sacrifice of both the people who survived the Depression all over the world, not just in the United States, and who'd gone through the war, a certain level of middle-class expectations of prosperity. Your children were always going to have a better life, materially at least, than you were. Those were set things. Now, the Cold War finished, the Soviet bloc fell, And that was simply an occasion for collective euphoria, for sort of celebration. The notion that you were kind of entering into a period, a sort of Einsteinian, you know, relativity, when everything, all institutions, you know, the stock market could dissolve and bring massive unemployment with it, along the lines of what happened 2 years ago at the end of 2008. The notion that whole political societies could sort of disintegrate and would have to be rebuilt, that we were going back to a kind of primordial soup politically in which everything was going to be reconstructed all over again, is genuinely scary. But it may not be a bad thing now in this country at this particular moment, and who knows, after the president's speech today or even before it, today, to have a debate again about the first principles that constitute government, whether you're trying to think of what is a political system that's democratic and fair in the Middle East, or what is it we have government for today in the United States.
Can we talk about Obama for a moment? You've been a big fan since he came on the scene and gained so much public awareness. You have written, and these essays stretch so much here. I mean, you're a fan of Thomas Carlyle, you know, writings with wild and wandering digressions.
Yes.
I mean, you've got all kinds of material in these essays. But Obama himself figures pretty prominently and often in a quite laudatory way. Now you've seen him on the job, as we have for these years. He's speaking big today. What do you think of this president and his style of leadership?
I would wish it to be a bit more brass knuckles, as I said, really. Here's the thing. One of the reasons I was excited about Obama was I did think he revived. It looked as though he was making explanatory eloquence a part of American life again. George Bush, right or wrong, was all about the kind of pithy, was about instinct, really, about American instinct, which can be heroic and noble and right, but it was about instinct. Don't be burdened by history. George Bush and what he stood for, really, was an authentic piece of American mistrust about the grandeur of language, about being over-articulate, about brooding too much, very much like Ronald Reagan, who said, here's a problem, I want to know about it in one paragraph. There's a lot to be said for that. It has a great long pedigree in American life. Obama was different. Obama's John Quincy Adams. Obama is the tortured Lincoln, as someone who can't always reads everything, saturated in history. Every major speech, not necessarily every successful speech, had an enormous historical component. Think about the speech at Cairo. Think about the speech at Oslo when he runs you through a short history of the theory of just war, all very historically informed. Now, I felt possibly, as a slightly disenchanted chucklehead now, maybe, that somehow this would not be incompatible with a kind of rather raw defense of the principles of government.
You called him the historian in chief.
I do. And I thought that would give him an occasion to be, I have to say, a little bit more out there in defense of the American Commonwealth. What the preamble to the Constitution and Article 1, Section 8 calls the general welfare of America than he's wanted to be. I hadn't quite anticipated that his concern, very much as he was as it was concerned when he was being elected, would be for what I call a big national cuddle, would essentially be for consensus wherever you could get it. And I've always wanted him to be a bit more like FDR. I know FDR worked with a much bigger majority than Barack Obama has had. But FDR, said famously in his re-election campaign in 1936, I know there are those out there who hate me and I welcome their hatred. You can't really ever imagine Barack Obama doing that.
Because he's cowed by the opposition or because...
No, I think he genuinely believes, and it's been the case ever since he was the editor of the Harvard Law Review, in bringing people together. You know, I think he's now wallowing slightly in this new, sharing a bathtub with John Boehner. I wish he wouldn't be so happy about it, is my view. I suppose I'm spoiling for more of a fight than he's willing to give me. And I bet there are millions of you out there, listeners, who feel the same way.
Does he have, we know he's eloquent, but does he have the kind of brass knuckles eloquence to bring that fight, do you think?
We'll see what happens in the election campaign, won't we? I mean, we'll see what happens today, actually, Tom.
Yes.
If he's saying, I'm sorry, we're not going to lower The top tax rates on America, on the wealthiest Americans, from 35% to 25%, or top tax rates on all Americans. We are actually going to, I've had enough of this. If we're going to protect Medicare, if we're going to protect entitlements, if we're going to protect the people who most need help in an unbelievably tough time, and if we have to end the Bush tax cuts for the top 2% of Americans, I'm going to do this because it says something about the integrity of what my government stands for. Then at last, I think he'll be out there. In a way, Paul Ryan's proposals on the revenue side, tax cut versus tax hike, have given him a dramatic opportunity to, you know, summon his inner FDR. You know, we'll find out, what is it this afternoon? We'll find out later.
Today, it's on its way. Some of our listeners may have heard it by the time they hear you and I right here. George Bush, instinct. Barack Obama, a kind of instructive eloquence, you call it. Which more potent in the proof in the pudding in the American arena in this last 10 years?
Instinct has been triumphant, I think. I mean, Bill Clinton was a genius about instinct, actually. Bill Clinton could turn, you know, wonkiness, really, into a kind of common language, really. I mean, that scene in Primary Colors, my friend Joe Klein's Primary Colors, and in the movie where he really is, you know, sitting there in Dunkin' Donuts or somewhere, actually. that is authentic. That is actually part of the Clintonian personality.
You think Barack Obama should start biting his lip in that way?
Heaven forbid, actually. But he's got to find some way where he's not going to be all embarrassed by the likes of Joe Plummer, because someone like Joe the Plumber is going to come at him again.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with journalist, historian, art critic, big thinker, Simon Schama, about our tumultuous world. Right now, his new collection of essays just out is Scribble, 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 Writing on Politics, Ice Cream, Churchill, and My Mother, his title, takes it from the Duke of Gloucester's remark to Edward Gibbon, another damn thick square book, always scribble, 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 Mr. Gibbon. Thanks, Simon Schama, for reminding us. And join us if you like this hour. Have you read Simon Schama over the years on revolution, history, art, politics, humanity? What's your question for our polymath right now on the world beneath our feet, the world unraveling, zooming around us? Simon Schama joins us from New York. Simon, here's a question from Brooke online. Everything's online or Twittered, or we'll get to the phones too. But here she says, I want to ask Mr. Schama if he sees echoes, and this gets into your wheelhouse, if he sees echoes of the French Revolution in what's occurring now in North Africa and the Middle East. Are we witnessing classic revolutions? Simon Schama.
Well, I certainly think we were in Egypt, really. And the most powerful reminder, really, was the occasion in Tahrir Square, which was, even though it went on longer than a crowd's pulling down the stones of the Bastille, it was what you saw, really, in Egypt, was the sense in which, first of all, the government didn't really belong to you. It was completely out of touch, and there was some sense of an unreformed political system, or a political system which did not yet exist in France in the 1780s, whose perquisites were really the property of a corrupt elite. And what you did against that was simply have a huge gathering of shared anger. And in the moment of that anger, in a particular place, you achieved you rediscovered a kind of civic friendship. You rediscovered what the French called fraternity at the time. And from that really generates hope, expectation, the feeling of rebirth. The French Revolution is taught all the time, again, using that word Renaissance, about being reborn as a kind of club of hopeful, being reawakened to becoming not just a subject but a citizen. The dark side of that sense of a permanent picnic, really, of actually being in this kind of clubbable relationship of simple trust with each other, what the kind of highfalutin theorists of these occasions called transparency, reinforced by Facebook's assumption that you're all together as friends and so on. The trouble with that is that it doesn't go anywhere, as we're discovering in Egypt really right now, unless there are people there who can convert it into organized political parties, into demonstrable set of principles that you can fight or for or against, and into the machinery of power. And the worrying thing, not to the point of consternation, but certainly to the point, I think, of some anxiety, is whether or not it's possible to convert all this youthful energy, this sense of being reborn from a subject to a citizen, into a machine that would allow you actually to take power peacefully through an election.
What do you say? I mean, back in February, you were writing something like, you know, quicker than you can say Danton, bloody terror is almost always the payoff.
Yeah.
Now we're in April.
I hope I'm wrong, Tom. I hope I'm wrong. But, you know, it's significant that the army remains very much in control of the kind of political operation, and we have to take it on trust that really they'll remove themselves from the elections when that finally happens. But it's possible that Egypt will go from a 1789 moment through to Napoleon Bonaparte moment, a populist general presenting himself as the incarnation of the nation without anything in between. And one really rather hopes not. There was a demonstration the other day, of course, actually, in the centre of Cairo, which was extremely brutally treated by the military authorities.
Some military involved in it, some of them shot. I wonder what you're thinking, speaking of French Revolution, thinking of this Louis or that Louis. I mean, the news of Hosni Mubarak held and questioned for, what was it, 15 days, we're told, and now maybe having some heart problems. I mean, this is the falling royal figure from classic.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, but it's very interesting. But actually, the physical body of the ruler in a kind of quasi or actual monarchy is of extreme interest to the citizenry who inherit. It's a choice between, you know, Hosni Mubarak, and it's true of Muammar Gaddafi and his, you know, weird sense of wardrobe too. Yes. The kind of physical appearance of these rulers is because they are kind of fake kings in some way. The claim is that I'm your big national daddy, and in my physical person, I represent all of you. So when that figure is delegitimated, when they actually fall from grace, the body politic belonging now to the citizens really is interested, wants to see that that physical figure was actually corrupt, you know, was entirely in it for his own greed, the satisfaction of his own appetites. This may yet be happening to Silvio Berlusconi and another and a different kind of set of appetites. But that is of interest and a rather awful
thing. It has to be pulled down or thrown out or...
Or actually physically punished and, you know, physically taken apart. There was one terrible moment way back. You kind enough to talk about my polymathery, but in 1672, when the richest country in the world, the little Dutch Republic, was invaded by the French and looked as though it was going to kind of collapse altogether, the brothers De Witt actually were taken out physically in this most usually peaceful society and physically mutilated and torn to pieces, and fingers and feet and toes and body parts were thrown, in fact, in some cases, it being Holland, sold to the populace at large. I don't want this to happen to Hosni Mubarak, but the fact that he's physically incapacitated is absolutely of a piece with the kind of revolutionary drama.
Simon Sharma's new collection of essays is Scribble, Scribble, Scribble. Simon, let me go to the phones. John in Barrington, Rhode Island, you're on the air with Simon Sharma.
Hey, great commentary. We have in this country, as you've alluded to, a tremendous complacency, but we have a need to change. Do you see us having the kind of rebirth or major change that you're talking about without a major event like a real war or a real depression?
Well, a very good question. One really ought not to wish for another calamity in either. I mean, it's John, right? I mean, frankly,
yes.
John, as Tom's saying, you know, if we're feeling historical overload, I think you know, I think we've had actually a fair do of calamity lately, starting with the, you know, disintegration of our economic life in the end of 2008. So I think we've had exactly, even though there's not been a civil war, we're commemorating the beginning of the civil war 150 years ago. I don't think we want to invite that on ourselves in order to have a debate about the first principles of American government. And, you know, whatever one feels about the Tea Party, and most of what I do feel about the Tea Party is critical, you have to say that their obsessive fetishizing of the Founding Fathers and the Constitution has the salutary effect, or ought to have the salutary effect, of inaugurating a great public debate in this country about what do we have government for? And it's a debate which has been, you know, inaugurated by the fierce quarrels between Alexander Hamilton on one side and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison on the other, who had absolutely different views about what we have a federal government for. And the time has come for that debate to be restarted. What is it that the government does for us, apart from protect the security of our shores provide certain basic, we hope, elements of infrastructure, roads, canals and bridges that even Jefferson would have recognised as legitimate? What is irreducibly part of what our government ought to do for us? Is Social Security part of that? Is the EPA part of that? That's the kind of absolutely first principle discussion that ought to be going on. But at the moment, it's really only people on the conservative right who have an extremely stringent and limited neo-Jeffersonian view about it, who have had the historical narrative pretty much all to themselves. You want to say, wake up, Alexander Hamilton out there, you know, your great-great-grandson must be out somewhere. Wake up, FDR. Wake up, Ickes and Harry Hopkins and those around Lyndon Johnson, and give the other view already.
I want to look at that historical narrative, but give us the advantage of your transatlantic perspective here, because that stringent view that let's reduce it big time is in action in the UK right now. How's that turning out? I mean, they've had a conservative government come in and make enormous cuts. What do you see unfolding there?
Well, they would want me to say it's too soon to tell, but I mean, you don't have very... If we're saying, look, we've had a trial of whether Keynesian principles or extreme deficit hawkery works in terms of repairing the damage done by the economic crisis, you have to say that until this particular moment of savage deficit cuts, the Keynesian model, most of the trends in this country in terms of the gentle, not enough, drop in unemployment rates, in terms of the way the stock market has responded to capital needs, in terms of the rebuilding of inventory and even consumer confidence, the Keynesian model actually hasn't done that badly. It's not done as well, and the pump has been not as primed as people like Paul Krugman and so on would want.
But the home of Keynes is throwing
Britain,
it out.
In Britain. Mm. Yeah, sorry?
Home of Keynes throwing it out.
Home of Keynes, indeed, throwing it out, going back to kind of pre-Keynesian view. And the results have not been hugely auspicious. George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and David Cameron were in the coalition generally, were in trouble for the rather feeble and stagnant growth figures that were much less encouraging than most people expected, that were available, I think it was around Christmas time. The economy is picking up a bit in Britain now. But if you look at the example of Ireland, for example, where a savage kind of deficit hawk policy was imposed, it's not had particularly cheering results at all in terms of economic recovery. Everyone thinks about, you know, the stimulus package being a huge gamble. The Republican view in the House of Representatives now, the kind of Ryan view of what we have to do, is at least as gigantic a gamble, because the possibility is that by actually being this savage right now, and the president has signed on for $39 billion worth of Republican fiscal ideology, you are sucking juice out of the economy, which at a time when really that's not what we necessarily need. So there is a huge gamble going on that side of the equation as well.
I wonder about the cultural impact of that kind of shift. You wrote in the Telegraph a couple of months ago that the cuts you were seeing in the UK, you wrote, will make history the preserve of the rich. Maybe some culture as well. What did you mean by that?
Oh, well, this is a very, very specific remark, Tom, where there's been a proposal to actually essentially introduce a kind of free market model of higher education, a much more American model of higher education, so that the government will only subsidize university education in Britain. It's had a very different history from that in this country, in science and technology and those kinds of measurably, I guess, you know, vocational, scientific, technological issues. Mm-hmm. Universities will have to balance the books on everything else, on humanities, on philosophy, on history, on literature, and so on, and charge the going rate. Now, the difference between, not to make this too parochial, between our two cultures on different sides of the Atlantic is that we've been lucky on this side of the Atlantic to live in a philanthropic culture, partly because government has sort of kept out of education, so that the practice by which it's common for private universities and some public universities to build up an enormous endowment which will generate scholarships is not the case in Europe, and it's especially not the case in Britain. So this is it means that you're going to have to be very well off to afford its equivalent of about $12,000, which may not sound much to parents and students out there who are paying a lot more for higher education, but it is really a shattering amount to pay. I do want to say, Tom, about the two cultures that, Tom, that the conservatism in Britain and in some parts of Europe too has not been historically as hostile to a more expansive role of what government might and ought to do. In 19th century Britain, for example, Benjamin Disraeli, sort of founder of new conservatism, was the first really to make issues of urban sanitation, public health, interest, for example, in legitimating what trades unions could and couldn't do, part of the Conservative Party. They sort of inherited in a weird way the old aristocratic view that something has to come between ordinary people and a meat grinder of the industrial economy. And that was a legitimate conservative sentiment in Britain, which much later on was inherited by the likes of Winston Churchill and Harold Macmillan and the kind of conservative governments I grew up with after the war, which were much less allergic to this slightly broader view of what governments can and can't do in society.
We're talking with Simon Sharma. Let's go to Jane in Durham, Connecticut. Jane, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I love your show. What a great conversation. Earlier, your guest mentioned that he wished that President Obama was more like FDR, and I just wanted to comment that I wish he was more like Teddy Roosevelt.
In what way, Jane?
The economic health of the country was kind of being strangled by Standard Oil, and Teddy came in and broke it up for the good of the country. We rebounded.
You want that two-fisted trust buster Teddy Roosevelt? Which Roosevelt, Simon Sharma?
Obama would be the iron fist in a velvet glove.
Yeah. What do you say, Simon?
Jane's quite right. And it's very interesting to me listening sometimes to Glenn Beck's obsession with kind of Woodrow Wilson as the kind of antichrist who, by creating the Federal Reserve, opened the hitherto pure body politic of American liberty to dark, satanic, crypto-socialist infiltration. Whereas Jane's absolutely right. It was Teddy Roosevelt, really, and in a generation that was sort of drinking deep on the kind of progressive exposure of cartels, trusts, of writers like Ida Tarbell. Teddy Roosevelt's view of republicanism partly owed itself to... Teddy Roosevelt was a great Hamiltonian, of course. He really rather excessively despised Thomas Jefferson for his fantasy. And it was Roosevelt who vastly expanded the legitimate criteria by which government could intervene inside the economy. And Roosevelt was, of course, responding to an America which had seen enormous and terrifying economic upheavals in the Depression of, certainly, recession of 1893-94. While he was in office, actually, in 1907-1908, the famous collapse of the market, to which the unlikely figure of J.P. Morgan wearing a white hat had to come riding to the rescue. Yes. These were all crises that, in Roosevelt's view, were caused by the over-concentration of finance capital, the over-concentration of cartelized industrial resources, and so on. And yeah, I think it's funny how Teddy Roosevelt's been a forgotten man of Republican politics. He's an embarrassment to conservative republicanism.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with journalist, historian, art critic, big thinker, Simon Chama, about our tumultuous world. Right now, his big new collection of essays over a few decades, a scribble, 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 writing on politics, ice cream, Churchill, and my mother. Will ask him maybe about his mother's cuisine, the old the table at home. He's a big scholar, of course, now based at Columbia, but you may know him from the BBC or PBS. Big presentations there on art, on history, and many, many terrific essays written, and many of them collected in this collection. He joins us this hour from New York. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Matthew. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for calling. You're on the air with Simon Chama.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to comment to Mr. Chama how inspiring I found the Power of Art series.
Oh, that's very kind.
Particularly
thank you.
Thank you, sir, so much. Particularly the Caravaggio, the Rembrandt, really gave me a sense of my place in the world and that I have choices. And as a struggling creative producer at the time, it just it sort of set some wheels in motion. And I just wanted to express gratitude there.
That's incredible.
That's great. Gratitude,
that's
welcome.
Just a bouquet. You are so nice. Thank you very much. Well, I think I'll go now, Tom.
Yeah, fine.
I could die happy.
Take your bouquet and go. Well, yeah. What about it now? In this collection, you're looking at Rubens and Turner, Rembrandt's ghost, Richard Avedon. What about the way, of course, we'll read you and be informed by it, but in our culture today, how do you see us being informed and not informed by the arts in a way that's helpful or not helpful to us trying to make sense of all that's going on?
Oh, I think art isn't a luxury at all. You know, just as I don't think history is a luxury. I don't think history is a stroll down memory lane. You know, I think history is fundamentally sort of engaged with the way we think about what it's like to live in a human skin. And art is essentially full of surprises. It pulls us up short, essentially, about the way we see, I don't know, just even in the most abstract level, the way colours work on our senses, the way shapes work on our senses, but also the way we see the human body, the way we figure ourselves in a landscape, the way we experience a street or a town or a human relationship. That's really what great art can do. It kind of throws a switch and you get this extraordinary kind of power surge of understanding and what it's like to experience the world.
So look at a couple of switches. Look at Rubens with the famous Rubenesque figures of women. Look at Richard Avedon with those muscular, you know, guys in the gas station carrying big tires, bare torso. I don't know. What switches get thrown which way with those two?
Well, I think Avedon had, I feel very strongly about this. Both those two are, if you like, theatre producers, really, of the human body and the faces.
Yes.
That there is an element in all of us, even though we're now on radio, you and me, Tom, and where we actually present ourselves to the world. And there is always a very interesting, sometimes a gap, but there's something to be seen, really, behind the way we comb our hair, the choice we make of clothes, of shoes, whether we stick out our jaw and suck in our gut or the other way around. And the most brilliant people who look very hard at the human body or the human face suggest something to us about the choices been made in the way in which we face the world. And sometimes they take this on trust and just give you the way Donald Rumsfeld or Ronald Reagan or Avedon's own father would do that. And sometimes they say, just look behind the image a bit. And Rubens actually was very good about that. Depends if it was kind of as well in his own way. Rubens is, they both, you know, Avedon used the camera lens, really, not simply as an accidental mechanical thing that would sort of register the way someone looked, but they could really very artfully, in the way he lit it, do something else. Rubens used the actual, his wrist, his fingers. He was described as having a furia de pennello, the kind of fury of the brush, and it was in this extraordinary thick lightning flicking, this extraordinary kind of energy which you could bring to a mouth or a breast or an attitude or a strut or a ruff round the neck.
Yes.
He could, you know, write whole chapters in the way we want to be seen in the world by people close to us.
So what's it mean that here you've got one culture holding up Rubenesque women in these wonderful oil paintings and another with these lean cut black and white Avedon macho guys?
How much can you read through that presentation about the culture behind it? Or is it just the artist, you know, each of them in particular that we're seeing?
No, I think we go through periods, probably when abundance, you know, of the human body is something to be unembarrassedly celebrated, actually, and where people have very low, you know, they don't have long life expectation, when abundance and the cornucopia is thought to be part of God's blessings, not just sort of product of wealth. And the natural thing to do is simply to celebrate it as nakedly as you really want. And you know, in our own time, really, abundance has become sort of self-caricatured as obesity, really, as just simply an entire culture stuffing its face with French fries. So it's something in the face of what we know of millions perishing of starvation in different parts of the world. So we're more embarrassed by abundance is something quite difficult, really, to make a matter of artistic or public celebration. So we go for the kind of lean, mean, stripped down, less is more. If there's a note of disbelief in my voice that you detect out there, listeners, you're absolutely right. I'm an abundance person, okay. as my editors complain about my adjectival overload, don't they, Tom? Right.
Loopy, have another ice cream.
Exactly.
All right, brace up, Simon. The internet brings us all kinds of comment, and here's a couple that will maybe help us look at your original home culture and where you're sitting now. Here's Jay says, another Brit talking about what gains your freedom. What gains you freedom is like asking a priest for marital advice. And then this one. Here we go. Goodbye Bloke writes, another Brit telling us what's what. Last week, two of three on the panel on Real Time with Bill Maher, British. The British are not our friends. They are users and the core of the corrupt financial industry that's destroying us. They are subjects. We are citizens. I am sick of the British telling Americans about America. It's unfortunate that we both speak English because the fact is misleading. The British are responsible for all the present-day problems in the Middle East. Here you span these two. How do you juggle, or do you have to?
No, well, it's great to hear this sort of ferocity of Anglophobia going on. Means the spirit of 1776.
Yes,
I'm waiting. To
Huzzah!
Do I have to get tarred and feathered really as I leave the studio? Probably. Right. I don't know what to say about the notion that really all the troubles in the world and all the Middle East really do come from Britain is, not the complete truth. You know, is Britain completely, has it got its sort of hands completely clean of trouble in the world? Of course not. There was a British Empire.
A lot of lines
But it's
drawn.
Good if it helps really to, if it helps whatever ails these people to really. I've lived in America for more than half my life,
right.
Actually. It doesn't necessarily entitle me to anything whatsoever, but I'm sorry we share the same language. Often I feel we don't.
You're just back from Israel. Tell us what you saw there. And in particular, I'm interested in the last few days, you know, we saw Richard Goldstone, who helped write this report out of the UN after Israel's military campaign in Gaza that was so devastatingly critical of Israel. And now he's published a kind of reversal of some of that analysis. What do you think about that? And how did you see it going down in Israel? I mean, after all, it was Netanyahu was talking about him as a major strategic threat, one of two or three major strategic threats to Israel because of that earlier criticism. What did you see there?
Yeah, I think Netanyahu's extreme criticism was pandering, really, to some of his more right-wing partners in the coalition, like his foreign secretary, Avigdor Lieberman, and Yisrael Beiteinu. But there was certainly in Israel a great deal of rather ferocious sort of satisfaction about the Goldstone's second thoughts, as confessed to the Washington Post. Politicians slightly less right-wing who I spoke to actually had always been very concerned, and what we think about this is a moot point, but politicians are very concerned to make a distinction between attacks that actually target, school bus suicide bombers and so on, people who set off bombs in restaurants and so on, as they see it. They want to make a distinction between people who want to make deliberately civilians the target of their ferocity and their own military policy in which there is collateral damage to civilians, the Israelis will want to say, and again, there's good reason for people to be skeptical about this, but their argument is, Zippy Livni made this argument for me, well, you know, she was in Olmert's government at the time of the grimly excessive and disproportionate caste-led operation in Gaza. She wanted to say, well, we knew that rockets are being fired from the center of civilian populations, or there were military installations there. What were we supposed to do? Tie our hands behind our backs? So it was that. It's that distinction between collateral fallout in terms of civilian casualties and targeted attacks on civilians by suicide bombers that the Israelis want to make. I'm not saying they're justified in doing that.
But of course, Goldstone originally called it the other way originally, which is what
he
caused distress. I mean, he said that,
yes,
you know, it was very tough on exactly that point, a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate terrorists. And now he's gone back. Roger Cohen in the New York Times says, well, that's just, he's just taken so much flack from the Jewish community that he had to retreat. Where do you come down? Goldstone was correct and now cowed, or wrong and now closer to correct?
I think he was wrong and now closer to correct. I think it's as simple as that. I'm not sure how much more one can say about that. And he was, you know, if he's surprised now about the kind of grimly jaw-clenching noises that are being made, you know, sort of noises of disgust, he shouldn't have been surprised about that. But I'm sort of glad he did have the second thought.
Chris, in Baltimore, you're on the air with Simon Sharma.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
We continue the, you know, the debate as the founders debated the role of government. I think most of us would agree that, you know, the role of government is to first represent the will of the majority. So my question, sir, is, you know, for many reasons, many of the majority of people don't participate in our government, and they don't engage in the process. My question would be, if you could go back and be in that room with the founders and inject something, some clarity of hindsight maybe, that would better serve the Constitution, would better serve that end of representing the people, the majority of people, what would that be maybe?
Oh, no, a Brit gets his mitts on the U.S. Constitution. But people are worried about representation these days. I don't know. What about it, Simon? If you could have a hand.
Actually, it's going to get me even more trouble with the Taras and Feathers.
Yes.
I'm a dead duck.
Turn up the heat. Bubble.
Yeah, crack. I think actually the issue of representation itself, in other words, how many people vote in elections, that's why I take part of the issue to be, is really low on our agenda. It's true we would like, you know, the numbers went up slightly, both in the last presidential election and the midterm election. That's a good thing. You know, would we like it to be more? Can social media help really mobilize the young in particular? There was a striking increase in the number of the young, the number of minorities and so on who were voting, particularly in the last presidential election. So the issue about how engaged is the citizenry in the actual process of elections, I wouldn't say is really, given all the problems we have, at the top of the list. But your
the sense of
your
being
listener,
represented seems
well,
something else.
I don't know what people expect. Mm. You know, I mean, if they expect the United States Constitution to produce at the same time energetic debate and cozy unanimity, you know, they want sunny weather the entire time. You know, from the beginning, of course, if you think about some of the early elections in American history, the election of 1800, for example, fought between Jefferson's Democratic Republicans, who were very much in favor of extremely limited government, and the Federalists, Adams and Hamilton themselves at daggers drawn for almost personal reasons. Mm. That was a ferociously unforgiving, but deeply illuminating election. It was the kind of election which, as I've said, I hope we'll kind of have in 2012. It represents two very truculently opposed views about what was the American way forward. And as you say, Tom, I'm enough trouble as it is without, you know, presuming to bring more clarity than that generation themselves brought to this debate about first principles. It's not, I think, the problem about how are we represented or misrepresented once Congress actually comes into being. One could argue about, and it turns out from today's news, that the lobbyists still have had a role in the way in which this recent budget deal finally came out.
Clearly.
And we can be indignant and angry about them being really something that comes between us and our represented members. It's really rather, what is the content actually of the legislation and the government which are represented, which accurately or inaccurately represent the will of the majority? What sort of arguments can we have about the substance of government? And the other thing that your listener said was, well, trouble is that most people, once an election is over, I'm putting words into his mouth now, are disengaged. That one wants not to happen, really. But in the last resort, you know, the citizens get the kind of democracy they deserve in that respect. Either you're paying attention or you're not. You're thinking more about Charlie Sheen.
What about the history we deserve? History is your base. You know, you called Barack Obama historian in chief. Republicans use history or a form of history a lot as well. You know, there was the bit of Michelle Bachmann talking about the founding fathers, you know, striving to abolish slavery. Well, there it is. Newt Gingrich, you know, teach history to teach patriotism. Well, sometimes it does, and sometimes it's more complicated. I mean, are we getting real history in this country's political discourse, or are we getting, you know, print the legend kind of myth history?
Well, I couldn't be happier that whether generated by conservatism or liberalism, that history really is right in the center of the way we think about what is happening to our politics. But I don't really want it just to be, people in Minuteman hats. That seems to be kind of fake history. People who fetishize the Constitution without noticing, as I say, that both the preamble and Article 1, Section 8 provide for the general welfare of the United States, and that there has been, over the generations, a substantial and deep debate about that. So we do need an informed, enriched, not just the history of T-shirts, bumper stickers, and people dressing up as Paul Revere.
Simon Chama, it's always a delight to speak with you. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. The new book is Scribble, 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 Writing on Politics, Ice Cream, Churchill, and My Mother. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for taking
the time. It's been a real pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Simon Chama, joining us there from New York, professor of art history and history at Columbia University. You can read an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.